step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hello, and welcome to episode 138 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Tom Hucker, Montgomery County Council member representing District 5 in Montgomery County, Maryland, and a former Democratic state delegate representing District 20 in Silver Spring and Tacoma Park, Maryland. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Thanks for having me. I'm good.
Great. The first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
I've spent my whole adult life as a, you know, as an organizer and activist, including as an elected official. I, during college and then shortly after college, worked in the environmental movement for many years, on federal legislation like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, on state legislation to clean up toxic waste dumps and other environmental problems. And then I worked for years as a community organizer and created my own group in Maryland, which was designed to build power for working families. And it brought together about 40 different community groups and unions and churches, and about 15,000 individual members to push somewhat at the local level, mostly in Annapolis, for state legislation that would benefit working families, like living wages. We pushed for years, the Purple Line, the Affordable Care Act, and expanded health care. And then in 2006, I was persuaded by a lot of people to run for the House of Delegates, and I served there for 8 years, and then 2 years ago, I was elected to the county council. So, you know, I've spent a lot of time as an organizer and now a lot of time on the council and in the assembly passing dozens of bills that you know, help the environment, raise wages for working families, and expand health care and transit and other protections basically for people's quality of life.
Well, you know, Tom, a lot of individuals get involved as volunteers in their community. They become potentially involved as community organizers. A lot of people feel passionately about the environment, but not many of those individuals become entrepreneurs and start their own nonprofit, as you did as a founder of Progressive Maryland. Can you speak for a minute to our listeners about what inspired you to create your own organization and then how you became so successful at pulling together 14,000 members over the course of only a few years as the leader and founder of Progressive Maryland?
Sure. I guess I had worked with several different, neighborhood groups and also a sort of nascent coalition of, unions and community groups and, just other activists from different groups, but, in a nascent sort of coalition in Montgomery County that was interested in, working on countywide issues. And, I think one thing that is under, valued, I guess, in a lot of casual meetings of activists is the need for sustainable funding and eventually to hire staff so you can do, you know, serious work year round, not just have meetings in the evenings when people are off work and have time, but, somebody really needs to be, if you're going to be an effective group, you really need staff to be working, organizing other volunteers and recruiting new members and advocating for your agenda, you know, during the day when most elected officials and policymakers are, you know, open to persuasion and having hearings and things like that on public issues. So we started raising money from a few Montgomery County organizations first to form what we called Progressive Montgomery. And then after several years of advocating in Montgomery County, we realized that there were not any groups like us advocating for working families issues at the state level. And the progressives in Maryland, like they are in a lot of places, are sort of balkanized. There's a cluster of progressive activists in the Baltimore area. There's a few scattered around other counties. There's some in Metro D.C. and Montgomery and St. George's, but nothing that really knitted them together into a statewide organization. So, we started holding meetings in 1990 to do that. I'm sorry, in 2000 to do that. And then, took the better part of a year to create a statewide organization.
Interesting. So a lot of times you find that in coalition building, some elements, as some different stakeholders, as you mentioned, could be balkanized, can be fractured, really focused on issues in their own backyard, whether it's chicken manure on the Eastern Shore, oyster farmers in Southern Maryland, air conditioning units in Baltimore County public schools. How is it that you were able, or was it not difficult, to try to unify individuals with disparate priority lists behind one set statewide agenda for all of Maryland to support working families?
That's a great question. I think, certainly on the broadly defined, left, most people have, you're right, an issue agenda around the interests of their organization, and they have other things they care about that would help their members. But are less important, but might help a greater good. So, I was really careful to create Progressive Maryland in a way that avoided, I think, some of the mistakes of other organizations. I went through a lot of community groups and unions and others, and sort of made the pitch that we weren't a rent-a-mob. Essentially, we weren't a bunch of people that you could just call and show up for your hearing. And didn't have any underpinning that held the organization together, except the service of its organizational members. What we tried to do was to get organizations to agree, regardless of whatever their top one or two or three priorities in Annapolis might be, that there were broader issues like healthcare or like living wages, or expanded transit. That might affect a much larger number of people, might not be the top issue on their members' agenda, but were something that their members would support, and challenge them to get behind a larger shared agenda, to help create an organization. So, and not everybody said yes. A lot of groups are just very focused on their small agenda, and they're frustrated by their lack of power, but they don't want to work on something else, we built the organization with groups that were willing to work on a larger agenda as well, as a way to give themselves a share in a larger organization that could build power over time.
So, Tom, I'd like to talk, to build on this idea of coalition building by speaking about the topic of infringement on turf. What I mean by this is I'm going to take an anecdote, a little story of the last few years in Maryland. A few years ago, Maryland state legislature, of which you were a part, legalized marriage equality, essentially permitting same-sex marriages. There was an advocacy organization called Equality Maryland that primary reason for existence was really advocating to get this to become law. Once it became law, eventually they ended up shutting down their shop, though there still are many different fights to be fought to advance LGBT rights. They really had their reason for existence removed, and they ended up shutting down. The reason I mentioned this is because when you build a coalition, if Progressive Maryland begins to become successful in advocating for a living wage, and of course the Montgomery County Council and the state of Maryland have both increased minimum wages in the last few years, and there's obviously current efforts to do that more. The question is, do you obviate the need for other organizations to exist? And if so, then you find that some organization, or have you found that some organizations have resisted joining you because they want to perpetuate their existence, and it's more important for them to remain relevant than it is for them to advance their issue. So did you face any kind of resistance to joining Progressive Maryland by those who may get subsumed into this larger umbrella group that you created?
Not that I can remember. I mean, I know the phenomenon you're talking about is some groups, you know, can be sort of turfy, for lack of a better term. But yeah, you know, like I said, there wasn't really a statewide group working on working family issues. You know, so we tried to fill that void. And, you know, to just be assiduous about making sure the work we were doing had some value added to all the organizations. And some organizations, you know, benefited more than others from the, you know, being part of a larger coalition. But, you know, on most of the issues, members, you know, didn't benefit directly because, like, the members of most unions and most even middle-class community organizations aren't low-wage workers on a state contract that were, you know, affected by our state living wage bill. But they, you know, they saw value in being part of a larger organization because when they had a bill before the county council or the state legislature, you know, being part of Progressive Maryland allowed them a forum where they could build relationships with groups that they didn't have relationships with previously. And, you know, like the old thing is, you know, you don't, the worst time to, you know, make a new friend is when you need a friend. You want to build all your friendships before you need them. And, you know, organizations that had an issue they were trying to pass or might have been under attack for one thing or the other, you know, they were glad to have new relationships with community groups that they really had no, you know, other place to meet them and to do shared work together. A lot of people found that very valuable, you know, when they were coming to Progressive Maryland Board meetings, for example.
So I'd like to transition a little bit back towards you personally, Tom. You've been an advocate for working families. I'd like to discuss how you arrived at that point as being an advocate for working families and delve a little bit into your personal life. You do have a wife, you have two young children, yet obviously when you started Progressive Maryland back in 2000, you did not have two young children. Can you speak a little bit about what led you to really identify with working families and seek to become their champion in the state legislature?
Growing up, I grew up in a working class neighborhood we had a stable family and a lot of assets that a lot of people, you know, have to go without. But I was sort of taught by my parents or whomever to be concerned about, you know, what people call the little guy or the disadvantaged or whatever. And, my focus has been, you know, I think less to do sort of, you know, take a charitable approach to, you know, poverty and other issues, but really to help people build influence collectively so they could make their government work as well as it was supposed to work, you know, for them. To make their government responsive. And, you know, when you train as a community organizer, that's what you're doing all day. You're trying to get, you know, a local council member, who your target is, or it might be a company, to respond to a collective, request from, you know, from the group you're building up. And, I guess doing that for years, maybe, you know, appreciate just the value of organizing and collective action. I was going to go to, I had planned originally, knowing just growing up and thinking I wanted to help people, but in a very apolitical way, I was going to go to med school and I, you know, was pre-med all through college. But it was a campaign when I was a sophomore in college, and I was involved with an environmental group, and, we in Massachusetts, where I went to school, we could petition issues onto the ballot that the state assembly hadn't taken, made a decision on. So at the time, Massachusetts had hundreds of toxic waste sites around the state, and there were dozens of communities that couldn't drink their own drinking water out of the tap because it was so contaminated by toxic waste in their groundwater. And there were I forget the numbers, but you know, many people, upwards of a dozen or more, dying, you know, associated with cancers from polluted drinking water every day. And the state,
was that documented in that movie with John Travolta?
Oh, well, you know, it's funny. I was at Boston College, and Woburn, where that movie was just a town or two away. But the problem in Woburn was really, you know, was captured in the book and the movie, but it was really common all over the state. And, you know, really all over an awful lot of northeastern states that had a big industrial base. So the lesson for me was the assembly had not acted on, had not put together an effective plan to clean up the toxic waste in Massachusetts. So we petitioned a bill that we had that had not passed onto the ballot, and the public passed it by an overwhelming majority. So it sort of made me realize I could spend, you know, my future in a lab trying to come up with a cure for cancer that many other smart people had never been able to come up with, or I might be, you know, able to affect more people, you know, prevent more people from getting cancer by organizing to pass more laws like that. Because if you did the math, you know, we were really having, you know, that law alone had a big impact on an awful lot of people's lives. So, and that was, it was fun to do. You know, we just gathered the signatures, put it on the ballot, campaigned for it, and people, you know, it's nice to be validated and to know people actually agree with you. And, you know, passed by about 70% plus margin. Michael Dukakis is getting reelected that year, and we got a lot more votes than he did. So, you know, it was empowering to me to learn that, well, I could be part of a campaign that just makes a new law that saves lives. And if I could do that, why wouldn't I want to, you know, keep doing that with, you know, with my jobs out of college? So that's where I decided not to go to medical school and to do environmental work afterwards.
There's a slogan at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health that says, saving lives billions at a time, whereas medicine saves lives one at a time. It sounds like that slogan applies a little bit to your work. You were seeking to prevent cancer on a population level, and you saw success in a ballot measure as an advocate. Is it fair to say that that campaign first is what got you interested in environmental matters, which continues to be of interest to you in your career as you've been a consultant for the Natural Resources Defense Council? Or did your interest in environmental activism predate your involvement in that ballot measure campaign?
No, that was really influential. I think I had, you know, canvassed and gone door to door where I grew up in St. Louis, you know, before I got involved with that campaign for the environment. But, you know, both of those things, initially going door to door to, you know, to clean up toxic waste in Missouri and then that ballot campaign in Massachusetts, both of those really, you know, contributed to sort of my view of the world and my appreciation for, you know, the power of collective grassroots action to force elected officials to do the right thing and to create change.
So we spoke earlier about your desire to build collective influence to create responsive government. Now, you are in quite a unique position, Tom. Not only have you created your own grassroots movement in the state of Maryland, which continues to exist to this day, but then you also served in the Maryland House of Delegates and now the Montgomery County Council. So two levels of government plus a grassroots activist. My question for you on this topic is, in making a transition from being an advocate and a grassroots organizer to being an elected official in the House of Delegates to then becoming an elected official in Montgomery County on the county council, have you experienced any change in perspective? Is there anything that you've seen in one with one identity that you did not expect in your previous identity? And is there anything that you wish you knew in a previous role that you now have learned through the various offices that you have held?
Wow, that's a big question. Is there anything I wish I'd known in a previous role? I think serving as an elected official gives you an appreciation of being both the level of detail that is often needed to make a good piece of legislation, and I'm not good at being patient, but it gives me an appreciation of the value of patience. You know, a lot of, and I, I you could probably imagine with the background I have. You know, I end up dealing with grassroots advocates quite a bit, and some of them ask me to put, you know, their bills in. Some of them ask, you know, lots of them ask me to, you know, support their bills, obviously. And I end up, you know, probably unfortunately for them, giving them a lot of unsolicited advice about their advocacy, because, you know, when you're on this side of the dais, you realize you kind of become good at, you know, separating effective advocacy from ineffective advocacy. And the advocates that I think do the best job, not only, you know, build power out in the field, but really cultivate good relationships with elected officials so that they can be seen as experts in their area and so they can be seen as persuasive. And, you know, a lot of that is their demeanor and sort of presentation. Because, you know, when I was an advocate, and I still do, you know, as an elected official, I have to get my colleagues to vote for things. You know, I try to really not let anything get personal, to, you know, not be surprised when people disagree, and to just try to, you know, use all the arguments you have and the facts you have to persuade people without becoming disagreeable or damaging your relationships, because it's a finite audience. You know, in the Montgomery County Council, it takes 9 votes. There's 9 of us, so it takes 5 votes to pass a bill and 6 to have a veto-proof majority. And somebody that might vote against my bill, you know, this week, I might need them on my bill next week. So there's no point in, you know, getting angry about the position they take. That's really up to them. And, you know, I try to uphold one thing you learn in the House of Delegates, which is not to stand up and impugn people's motivations and say, oh, they're taking that position because of their campaign contributor or because they're just insensitive or something. You know, we all have different experiences, and I don't claim to know anybody else's experience at all, just my own. So, you know, if I can't persuade them to support one bill, I just try to, you know, see them as an individual and hopefully listen to them enough to figure out if there's some arguments maybe that I am not using that might persuade them. And if I don't get them on this bill, I still try to maintain a good personal relationship so I can try and persuade them on the next bill.
So on the change of perspective question, there must have been a time when, as an advocate, you were frustrated with elected officials. Do you have any more sympathy for those elected officials that you worked with in Annapolis and in Boston?
Well, yeah. I mean, sympathy is the right word. I certainly understand, you know, I think where they're coming from. But I guess that part's never been as hard for me as for some other advocates. I right now have, good friends some elected officials that have never voted for any of my bills, and other elected officials that, you know, were the targets of an advocacy campaign that I was leading that, you know, got pretty heated and they got pretty frustrated with the postcards and emails and letters I was getting sent to their office. You know, now we're good friends because I think they understand, and I certainly have always understood, well, I have a job and they have a job. And, you know, we just try to, I just try to persuade them and, you know, move on to the next thing, like as I said.
So, Tom, we're actually approaching the end of the podcast right now, and so I'd like to ask you one last final question.
Sure.
Which is to speak to our listeners about why you've done it, why you've dedicated decades to advancing the public interest, often in a non-remunerated volunteer capacity, often as an overworked, underpaid activist, and now as an elected official in two separate capacities. Could you speak to our listeners about why it's been worthwhile and what, at the end of the day, you hope your legacy will be? What will you have accomplished through all that you've given to public service throughout the course of your career?
Wow, you have big questions, Jordan. I think I got into it, as I said, to, you know, just sort of help people in a vague way. And the more you learn about, you know, the structures of power in our society, you realize that that there's a lot of unfairness and inequity, and there's a lot of structural reasons that people don't have, you know, the quality of life that they would like to have. And that, you know, that organizing and collective action and well-crafted legislation all can be tools to, you know, improve people's quality of life. So, you know, the more I got into it, the more I, you know, just become satisfied doing the work. I think the work is fun to do. It's not fun every minute of every day, but I don't know any job that is. And it really, you know, it's a great privilege to be able to be in the position that I'm in on the council and to work with the people that I get to work with, who are all very smart and dedicated in their, you know, in their own right. And many of them know much more about all kinds of different issues than, you know, than I know. And it's a great environment to work in, where you have the ability to improve a lot of people's lives, you know, really every day. And, you know, that's so, you know, another thing is it suits my personality, you know, to have the opportunity to be a generalist a little bit. I mean, I don't think I could be a college professor and just, you know, specialize in medieval Italian literature, you know, exclusively, and be a world expert on that and very, very few other things. In this job, you really have to, you learn at least a little bit, hopefully a moderate amount, about a lot of different things. And, you know, on the council, just as in the state assembly, we're dealing with environmental issues and transportation issues and healthcare issues and service delivery. You know, I like that. It certainly keeps the work very interesting as well as being very satisfying.
And that has been Tom Hucker, Montgomery County Council Member from District 5 and former delegate from District 20 in Montgomery County, Maryland, and the founder of Progressive Maryland. Tom speaks about his time in public service as an advocate for the little guy who's gone out there and found success in building collective influence to create responsive government. He has since become part of government, and his interest in making it more responsive to people is driven by his desire to advocate for working families, for the environmental movement, and to really be a coalition builder who understands real politics and is okay with building coalitions with individuals who are allies today and foes tomorrow, and he recognizes that today's foes may very well be tomorrow's allies. He is a generalist who takes pleasure in maximizing his opportunity to have a positive impact across society, regardless of the issue. And in that capacity, as an advocate, as someone who stands up for someone who doesn't quite have the strongest voice out there, and as a representative of a diverse coalition of individuals, progressive individuals across the nation, from Missouri to Massachusetts to Maryland, Tom has worked to advance the public interest through his life of public service as an advocate, as an elected official, and as an advocate for the everyman. Tom, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity, Jordan. That was a great recap.
And this has been episode 138 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. Remember to subscribe at publicinterestpodcast.com. Listen on iTunes, your podcast app, SoundCloud, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Stitcher. Should you wish to communicate with Tom, you can leave him a voicemail at 240-630-0380.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.